The ceremony hall is covered from the inside. All the walls are covered with figures, Buddha figures, and there are apparently 10,000 of those. And so that's how the name can be explained, City of 10,000 Buddhas. Now, the City of 10,000 Buddhas is a Chinese Buddhist monastic community, and it's located in Talmadge, Northern California, close to Ukiah, about 110 miles north of San Francisco. I was there last year in January and February for 2 months, and I returned to the same place this year for 25 days. Before I start off, I'd like to ask you, whenever you have any technical questions, like certain Buddhist terms that I've missed explaining or whatever, then just go ahead and ask. The talk or the presentation will be structured in the way that I'll start talking about the Sino-American Buddhist Association, of which the City of 10,000 Buddhas is part. Then after that, I'll focus the attention on the City of 10,000 Buddhas and all the activities going on there. And then we'll have a look at who is the abbot of that place, what are the characteristics of the monks and nuns there. And then towards the end, I'd like to say a few things about the Chan meditation session that I attended and that took place there. And hopefully there will be some time left for questions. So if you have any really important questions, feel free to just ask. And it makes it probably more lively too. So let's start out with the Sino-American Buddhist Association. Its goal is to bring the teachings of the Buddha to the entire world. In order to achieve this goal, three ways are pursued. The first one is to provide facilities such as monasteries, temples, and a university and schools that offer an extensive and complete cross-section of Buddhist studies and practices, which give individuals an opportunity to engage in a vigorous schedule of personal cultivation towards enlightenment. Now, right here, I'd like to stress two words: enlightenment and cultivation. You might know that, at least among the Catholic monastic tradition, a goal is holiness, to strive for holiness. Now, in a comparable manner, this is enlightenment for the Buddhists, in particular in monastic communities. And in doing so, or doing this, is called following the way of cultivation. So you're cultivating yourself towards enlightenment. Now, the second way of bringing the teachings of the Buddha to the entire world is for the Sino-American Buddhist Association, the translation work, the translation of Buddhist scriptures into all major world languages. And the third way is to promote a program of social action that shall bring about, as they say, happiness and peace among all living beings. The Sino-American Buddhist Association was founded by the venerable Tripitaka master Xuan Hua, who serves as the chairperson of this association and at the same time as the abbot for a number of monasteries throughout the West Coast in the States. And there's later on another monastery in Hong Kong. The association was founded or established in 1959, and it is a federally and state-approved non-profit and religious and educational corporation. So just that for its legal aspect. Now, the organizational structure of this association, there are three monasteries along the West Coast. Then there's one in Hong Kong. There are a number of temples all over the country. Then there's what is called the Buddhist Text Translation Society. Now, it is the aim of this society to translate, in particular, sutras, which are the Buddhist scriptures. For Christians, it's the Bible. For the Buddhists, we're talking about sutras, to translate those from Chinese into English and then further on into Spanish and other languages. And the Buddhist Text Translation Society has, to this point, put out more than 100 publications. Furthermore, we have the Dharma Realm Buddhist University, which is part of the same association, and there it is possible to pursue graduate and undergraduate studies in fields like Chinese studies, Buddhist studies, Eastern and Western art, and translation work. And that university is located at the City of 10,000 Buddhas and is very and emphasizes very much so the practical aspect of learning. That is to say, it's not entirely just theoretical, as is the case for most of the state universities here and in a lot of other countries too. So that means if somebody wants to study at that university, he ends up joining in or participating in the monastic life. And furthermore, we've got the Buddhist Council for Refugee Rescue and Resettlement. Now, what is this? This is part of the social program, and it's a refugee center, one of 13 volunteer refugee centers in the U.S. And Southeast Asians, at the beginning from Vietnam, now from Cambodia and Laos, have come through this refugee center. They stay there for about 3 months, and they're being taught English. They get an introduction to the American society. They learn about how to find a job, how to find a place to stay, and all other kind of valuable practices or stuff. Now, the members of the Sino-American Buddhist Association are 40 monks and nuns, and then a whole group of lay people, and I don't know exactly how many of those exist. The funding, a few words about that. Mostly, the Sino-American Buddhist Association depends on donations, and rumors has it that the government of Taiwan and Malaysia has over the past years subsidized the place quite a bit. And that makes it possible to have people stay there, be a novice, become a monk in the end, or just participate in what they call the two-year laity training program, which emphasizes certain Buddhist aspects. The monks and nuns there can be characterized as having a rather high standard of scholarship, and that is very important. They live their lives according to Buddhist precepts of moral conduct for the monastic community. And there are 250 of those precepts for the men and 348 for the women. And among those precepts are vows of poverty, celibacy, harmlessness, prohibition against involvement in worldly entertainment, and a number of ascetic practices, such as one eating only one meal a day, and sleeping upright in meditation posture. Now, in order to visualize that, they do sit in full lotus posture. Like, I can't really do it with my boots on, but like this, and they sleep like this. So, in order to explain, or to Well, I've been asked, why do they do that? And I think one of the reasons is that they... First of all, they don't want to live a luxurious life, and they're very, very vigorous. And apparently, it helps sitting in that meditation posture. You're much more aware of things, and it's a lot easier to go from sleep then into meditation once you're in that posture. And for a lot of people, it's hard to understand, how can you sleep in that posture? Well, what happens is that those monks and nuns just get overwhelmed by fatigue, that they just doze off, and then they go like this. And you could sleep that way, definitely.
Just a question.
Yeah.
Did you do that?
No, I didn't sleep that way. I slept lying down properly in my bed. Yeah. Pardon me? They do all their sleeping that way. Mm-hmm. At least, if you're a monk or a nun, then you're kind of asked to do it that way. And I found in one of the books or brochures here that apparently the Buddha attained enlightenment while he was lying underneath the Bodhi tree with his right side on the ground. So one of the rules for the monks and nuns, and this sounds a little bit cute and funny, is that they are supposed to lie down that way too if they want to sleep. Although I'm contradicting myself.
Do they have beds?
They do have beds. But they're probably hardly used. Okay, so that's that. Now, five precepts are valid and have to be observed by lay residents, visitors, and guests. And those five precepts prohibit killing, which even includes eating only vegetarian meals. Because if you eat a meal that includes meat, then you're participating in the process of killing an animal. And so they refuse to do that. You're prohibited to steal. You should not indulge in improper sexual conduct. Now, what does that mean? First of all, at the city of 10,000 Buddhas, men and women are strictly separated. Except for the Buddha hall, where the men sit on the one hand side, or are on the one hand side, and the women are on the other side. Same thing in the dining hall. The men are on one side, the women are on the other side. And the quarters, the living quarters, are separated too. Now, the reason for that is just that they think a lot of distractions come about sexuality in general, so they just try to cut that short immediately. And my personal experience was that it is very, very helpful for meditation to have the genders separated. It just, there's less distraction going on. Another precept for lay people is not to indulge in wrong speech, which means not to use harsh words, not to lie, and just to watch what you say, and even to limit your speech to what is kind of necessary. So no idle talk. And then furthermore, the taking of intoxicants is prohibited, and those are alcohol, drugs, and tobacco. So no cigarettes on the ground, of course, no drugs. The different methods of practice that are taught and cultivated at the city of 10,000 Buddhas are, first, according to the Pure Land School, the recitation of the Buddha's name. Now, what's that? That's just reciting Namo Amitofu over and over and over and over again. You do that all day long. And those sessions last up to a week. And you've got, you know, after an hour there's a break of, let's say, 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and then you go back into the hall and you start reciting the Buddha's name over and over again. And then sometimes the weather is nice, then the monks and nuns and the lay people just file out of the ceremony hall and then walk in a line all over the property. So it's kind of an impression that you're not used to. Pardon me?
What's his name?
Namo Amitofu. Namo is just, it can't be translated, and Amitofu is the Chinese version of Amitabha Buddha. And I guess inciting or by doing that, you probably clear your mind. I'm not too sure about that because I haven't really read it. I haven't done that much of it, and so don't know too much about the theory of it, the theory behind it. The only thing I know is that last year we did that for a week, and it was just awful. It drained all my energy. Towards the end of that week, I was just, gone. Yeah. Well,
I mean, is that the week before? And
in this case, it was exactly that way.
Yeah, I'm sure it's probably in preparation.
Actually, you're right. You're right. It is a preparation for yourself. You recite the Buddha's name, so you get in tune with the Buddha. And then the next thing is during the Chan meditation session, then you ask yourself. You're supposed to ask yourself the question, who am I? Who's referencing the Buddha? So it's built on top of each other. It's all interconnected. So I've mentioned Chan meditation. Chan is the Chinese word for meditation. You might be familiar with the Japanese word, which is Zen, which means meditation. And then I'll talk about the Chan session at the end of the presentation in detail. Then there's what they call bowing. Now, I should probably show you how that goes. That's another practice of being mindful or cultivating the way or whatever. For instance, like if you stand in the Buddha hall, then you've got everybody has a kneeling cushion in front of him or her. And there are always about four or five, I think, in a row. And then you go like this, and you do that mindfully. You try to be concentrated on that. You touch the ground with the forehead, and then you stay in that position for a while, and then you go back like this. And then oftentimes they do three in a row or six in a row. And that kind of bowing is part of most of the ceremonies, let's say, like the morning ceremony or the evening ceremony. What else do we have here? Vinaya. Vinaya stands for the moral, discipline. And I could give you here just a few precepts that are valid for novices. And in great detail, it is laid out what novices have to observe, and that holds true for the monks and nuns too. As I said earlier, they have 250 respectively, 358 precepts. And so we've got one here, studying the texts, entering the monastery, entering the Chan hall with the assembly, working, taking a bath, going to the toilet, sleeping, around the fireplace, in residence, going to a nunnery, visiting private homes, begging for food, going into town, at the market, not acting on one's own, going on a pilgrimage, and terminology for sashes and robes. So everything is really regulated rather strictly or rather intensely comprehensive. And I heard from one monk that especially these rules, this code of moral conduct, becomes later on in your cultivation very, very important to stick to those, because there's a value to them. Then furthermore, we've got the method of practice of the secret school, which is the mantra recitation. Now, you probably know what a mantra is. You might have heard of the mantra Om, or as we at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, they would take a few lines out of a particular sutra and then recite those lines over and over and over again. And they sound really good because in Chinese, in the Chinese language, you only always have very, very short syllables and they rhyme perfectly. And so the sound you create is kind of monotonous and it really gets into your mind. And with English or German, whatever, you can't create the same effect. It's just a language problem there. And then the last method of practice that is being taught or cultivated at the City of 10,000 Buddhas or within the Sino-American Buddhist Association is it's studying and investigating the sutras. And they do that a lot, and I'll talk about that later on. The City of 10,000 Buddhas, first of all, we're talking about a place that used to be previously the Mendocino State Hospital, a mental hospital until 1972, when the place was closed down for, I guess, political reasons. And then for 4 years, the place was on sale, and then finally the association purchased the property and turned the whole place into a monastic community. And it covers an area of 488 acres, and there are 61 buildings among meadows, among ponds, among small forests, and it looks really, really nice. Part of it is laid out as a kind of botanical garden, and it's really fun to just wander around. There's a walnut tree farm on the property. There's, as I mentioned earlier, the refugee center. Then there's the Tathagata Monastery. That's where the men stay. And then you have the Great Joyous Giving House. That's where the women stay. And those two buildings or complexes are totally apart. Then there's the Buddhist Text Translation Society, the university, then two schools. One is the grade school, the other one is the high school. The Cultivating Virtue High School and the Instilling Virtue Elementary School and the Acupuncture Clinic. What I might mention at this very point, those two schools, or in those two schools, they really emphasize Buddhist principles quite a bit, like compassion and being happy and joyful and not harming people and stuff. And both schools are run by the monks and nuns.
Are they boarding schools?
There's a boarding school too.
Who goes to them?
Well, there are the refugee kids. Then there are a few kids of lay people, and there's one guy who's about 14. His mother is a nun there, and nobody knows exactly where his father is, so he attends that school. And then there are a number of students who come from the surrounding areas, like Talmadge Ukiah, and people who are probably, I assume, Buddhists are at least interested in that, and assume that the school is a good alternative to state schools. Now, let's talk about the abbot, a short biography, a portrait of this man. The abbot, his name is Xuan Hua, Master Xuan Hua. He's a Chinese. He was born in 1908 in the northeastern part of China. He was the youngest of eight children. And when he was 19 years old, his mother died. And at that time, he left the home life, which means he intended to become a monk. And then he bowed, as I showed to you, from where he was living at, where he was raised at, all the way to the venerable master Chan Chi, who lived at the different place. And that was a bowing pilgrimage. I'll talk about that later on too. And he received from this venerable master the 10 novice precepts, and then started meditating and reciting the Buddha's name along or at his mother's grave. He was sitting in an A-frame shaped hut there, and he sat there for 3 years, and he didn't leave the place. And he would meditate sometimes for 3 weeks in a row, and enter, as they call it, a samadhi, which is a higher form of meditation. It's a sort of trance. And the story is related that, I don't know whether this is true, but that's what I read, that during one night, the villagers who lived close by all of a sudden saw bright rays coming out of that hut, and they thought the hut was on fire, so they ran over there and tried to extinguish the fire. But when they finally got there, they realized there was no fire. It is being said that probably the master, while he was sitting there, while he was in great trance, produced these rays. So it's up to you whether you believe it or not. After the Second World War, the master traveled to the Canton province and received there the complete bhikshu. Bhikshu stands for monk precepts at the Putu Mountain Monastery. And then later on, he continued traveling and finally met the very, very famous, then famous, Venerable Master Sui Yun, who was 109 years old at that time, and in a direct mind-to-mind transmission received inner enlightenment. And that way he became the ninth patriarch of the Huaiyang lineage. Now that's something that's kind of difficult to explain. It's probably similar to, let's say, the Native American Americans' tradition to pass on the chiefhood to the next person. And so in the same way, one master passes on his knowledge and his attainment to somebody else. Now, this master, Xuan Hua, wouldn't be able to get that transmission without having achieved any attainment or anything at all. So I guess that through sitting for 3 years at his mother's grave, he probably did attain quite a bit of experience and knowledge and intuition, whatever, insight. From there, the Master Xuan Hua traveled to Hong Kong, and it was the time of the revolution in China, and so a lot of Chinese people left the country and went to Hong Kong. And the abbot then was asked to establish monasteries and temples in Hong Kong, and he did so, and he stayed at Hong Kong for 12 years. And then in 1962, he finally arrived in the United States. And for 6 years until 1968, he didn't do anything. He just waited. And as I read it in one of the biographies, he waited for the karmic fruits to ripen. Now, that probably means he waited for the right moment, for the right time and the right place to come. And then in 1968, he led or conducted a 96-day-long Sharangama Sutra assembly, which was a study group. And at the end of that study session, five people decided to become bhikshus, respectively, bhikshunis, which are nuns. And so that way, the first monastic community in the Chan tradition was started here in the United States. And ever since, this monastic community has thrived quite a bit. They're expanding really incredibly fast. The abbot himself has conducted or explained the teachings of the Buddha and their application to the cultivation every day, or once every day, since 1968. So he has, over the years, brought a lot of Buddhist doctrine here to the States, and the sutras have been translated, and his commentary has been added to that. So it is something that is rather outstanding, and I know that in a lot of other Buddhist communities, this aspect of studying and becoming knowledgeable in the doctrine is not very much pursued. They're all into meditation. That's the big thing, or the big deal for them. Now, the abbot is believed to have performed a few or caused a few miraculous events, such as healing and finding a well at the city of 10,000 Buddhas. So once again, I'm not too sure about that either. So I'll just read out something to you and leave it up to you. In 1976, when the Sino-American Buddhist Association acquired what is now the city of 10,000 Buddhas, the property had stood empty for 4 years. An apparent lack of water had kept other buyers away. Once the property had been purchased, the venerable master was asked to choose a place for a well to be drilled. It was August, the middle of the dry season in Ukiah Valley. But when the venerable master went out to choose a well site at the south end of the property, black clouds gathered, and for a few minutes rain poured down amid thunder and lightning. The well was drilled, and at 230 feet, clear water gushed forth like from a spring. To the amazement of the people of Ukiah, the well at the city of 10,000 Buddhas faithfully produces over 500 gallons a minute. And I've seen those two water tanks that they have close by, so the water is there. So that's that. And last year, something strange happened. It was during a sutra lecture. The abbot was sitting up there on the stage and lecturing, and I was kind of scared or frightened to a certain extent by him, because he is a rather probably powerful person or whatever. And just a minute or 2 minutes afterwards, the abbot said, "Well, none of you should be afraid of me, nor should you be afraid of each other. We're all cultivators of the way." And it was just funny to hear that very moment afterwards. And so it's almost as if he can read minds. Some people say that he can do that. I myself, I've never seen him being angry, upset, uptight in any way at all. He's always very, very balanced, very centered within himself. Quite a person, very reliable. And he has been able to run these various monasteries along the West Coast and to all the other institutions that belong to the Sino-American Buddhist Association in a rather strict manner, keeping up the discipline. And I'm pointing this out because at the San Francisco Zen Center just last year, the Roshi there, who's the head of the center, he's an American. He was asked by the community to step down because he had had affairs or relationships with three of his female students, although he was married. And that is a thing you don't do in such a monastic community, in particular a Buddhist place. And another example is the Japanese Roshi at the Zen Center in Los Angeles. He recently admitted in public that he is an alcoholic, and he's now going for detox. I think he was in a detox institution for a while. So there's nothing of that sort at all at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Other than that, he's a great scholar, very, very knowledgeable, and a modest person too. And I heard from the monks and nuns there, from lay people, that they really have a great deal of respect for him. In the first place, I remember last year, when I first saw him, there was nothing special about him. He was just so quiet and withdrawn, and I thought, well, what the heck? And it's only after, well, a year in between and seeing other places and other people that I realized there is a certain strength to be the way he is and to see what he represents. A few words now about the monks and nuns there. Let me just try to give you an idea of what kind of people they are, how they behave and stuff, where they come from. Let's see. This is a book called Living Together Alone, The New American Monasticism. And there's the chapter on the Gold Mountain Monastery in San Francisco and the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Both of them belong to the same association. And here's a kind of interesting paragraph on one of the monks and how he became a monk. Hangshun, born Gregory Vilsack in 1951, grew up on the west side of Chicago. The profile of Hangshun in one of Gold Mountain's publications states, high on his list of favorite pastimes were lying, stealing, drinking, and fighting. Gregory got so involved in his destructive lifestyle that he ignored his studies and failed every subject in his high school sophomore year. It is difficult to imagine this quiet, withdrawn man as the same person described in the journal. Following a period in a military academy, Hangshun reverted, says the biography, to his former ways. Somehow, his life changed. And after a growing interest in Eastern religions, he went to Bangkok, where he lived in a monastery. As the result of reading the biography of the master Xuan Hua, Hangshun decided that he would follow him. With a single reading, Hangshun relates, I knew the master was my teacher. The feeling was that strong. I had never recognized anyone as my teacher before, and being conceited, I thought I didn't need one. But after reading about this master, I faced the east and bowed to him 1,000 times in the morning and 1,000 times in the evening for 4 days straight. In June of 74, I took off my monk's robes in Thailand, bought a plane ticket to San Francisco, and changed my diet to eat only vegetarian food. I arrived at Gold Mountain, but only stayed a week for the first time. To truly cultivate the way as people do here is not an easy matter, and frankly, I was caught off balance, chickened out, and ran home. But 2 months later, he returned, and on July 24th, 1975, Gregory Vilsack became Hangshun, a novice at Gold Mountain Monastery. So that's just one case here. There are people, there's one layperson I know. He used to be a Marine, and he fought in Vietnam for 2 years. He's a really peaceful person. He couldn't be more peaceful now. And he's been around for 9 years at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. There, in particular among the American monks and nuns, those who have excellent degrees, masters, PhDs from places like Stanford, Harvard, Columbia, UCLA, University of California, Berkeley, in various fields, Chinese, literature, English, journalism. There's one guy from Malaysia. He has a degree in engineering and worked for the Malaysian government for 12 years, and he decided to become a monk. Yeah. In terms of nationalities, that might be another question, perhaps. There are, as I said, American monks and nuns. There are a lot of Chinese descendants from countries such as Taiwan, China, Japan, Thailand, Singapore, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Hong Kong. Then there's one guy from England, and there's somebody else from Canada. Now, if you see, in order to give you a picture, what does a monk look like? First of all, they're shaved, bald, totally, both men and women. Once more, hair is being viewed as something that can create distraction. And then the monks and nuns wear gray robes, and above those robes, brown sashes, and they all have a kind of uniform standard, or, well, the standard form of sandals they wear. And most of them are pretty slim, and you can imagine eating one meal a day, you can't get too fat. They all look fairly healthy, and I haven't heard of any physical health problem lately. And those guys are really vigorous in their practice. I'm saying this once more because I've been to the San Francisco Zen Center and can at least compare with that place. And people there, at least the larger majority, is not as sincere and not as vigorous as people at this monastic community here. They're contemplative people. At the same time, they are alert. Sometimes I was amazed at what they see, what they feel, what they sense, just walking around and observing stuff. Very, very sensitive. And then straightforward in speech and action. And that means no idle talk. If they want to say something, they say it. They don't go around it. It happened to me a number of times that I would just strike up a rather dull conversation just in order to say something, they would just cut me short, or don't respond, or walk away. And the reason for that, once more, is just that they think talking too much is a waste of energy, or a loss of energy. And some of you might be able to relate to that. They're quiet. They're really quiet people. That goes along with talking. There's a lot more silence than at this place here. A lot more. Meals, for instance, are during mealtime. There's silence. Nobody talks at all. So you've got time to concentrate on your meal, to taste really what you're eating, and still be mindful. The people at the City of 10,000 Buddhas seem to be overall rather peaceful and happy. It is a happiness that comes from the inside, a joy that comes from the inside. It's not hypocritical at all. There's something behind it. They're hard and diligent workers. Whenever something needs to get done, either in physical work or mental work, they do it, and they do it properly, and they're very diligent about it. Overall, those guys seem to be rather balanced, and there's no spiritual pride, as one can expect, at least a few of them, or some of them. And what I found rather positive was there was hardly any, no proselytizing, in the sense that they tried to talk me into Buddhism, become a Buddhist, like, just to quote an example, fundamentalists do. There was nothing of that. Buddhists altogether seem to be really, really tolerant as far as other religions go. They don't have any problem with that at all. They can accept somebody else and incorporate other religions really easily. And this is something I got out of this book, but it holds true for the City of 10,000 Buddhists too. The doctrine doesn't seem to be too important, the dogma. During the day, well, they just live it. They don't talk about it too much. It's not theology, it's not theoretical. It's practical, it's applied. Now, the daily... Pardon me?
Did you find that something different at a Catholic monastery?
What the doctrine is?
Yeah, I mean, were they more involved in the theological and as opposed to the practical or applied?
Well, you're right. No, not really. It was kind of the same thing there. It seems to be an overall feature for most monastic communities that dogma isn't that important. It is the background, kind of, the basis, but it's not being explored in a theoretical sense all the time. Now, the daily schedule at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, this is the ordinary, the regular schedule. Oftentimes there are sessions going on and then a different schedule applies. You get up at 3:30 in the morning. And then from 4 to 5, there's a morning recitation, which is a form of worship. And that includes recitation of the Sharangama and other mantras, reciting sutras and the Buddha's name, devotional chants, worship of the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and patriarchs. Now, Bodhisattvas are, you can translate that as being enlightenment beings. People in the past who have attained enlightenment. They're called bodhisattvas. And within the Buddhist belief system, there's certain bodhisattvas who represent like compassion or other values. Then from 5:10 until about 7:30, there's either meditation or bowing, whatever one chooses to do. Now, I'd like to explore bowing a little bit more. Some of you might have heard of two monks bowing all the way, or performing a bowing pilgrimage, actually, from Los Angeles, from the monastery there, all the way up to the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And that's about 700 miles, and it took them 2.5 years. And the whole thing was called Three Steps, One Bow. And so the way the guys did it was, you go 1, 2, 3, and then you go down like this, as I showed before, and you go like this, and then you come up again. And they did that through cities, through the country, through hassle, and through everything. And it's, well, to them, it's a form of practice, of cultivation, trying to get rid of false thoughts, trying to get rid of the ego that, according, once again, to Buddhist belief leads to desire, to jealousy, to greed, and things like that. Those two monks later on put out they published their diaries, put their diaries together, and I've read some of it. It sounds really, really interesting, and you can tell that they were very, very serious about it. And while this bowing business or bowing pilgrimages is not a thing that has been started just recently, it's actually an old Chinese tradition. And like the Master Xuan Huo, he himself, he bowed from where he lived at in northeastern China too. This one master at the Putu Mountain Monastery, right? Let's see what else. Oh, yeah.
Is there a theology of afterlife?
Yeah, rebirth, karma. Shall I just briefly touch a little bit the doctrine, as far as I know? Because I don't know too much about it. And it's kind of difficult sometimes, too. Well, in any major religion, you have certain assumptions about death, life after death, and such. And so for the Buddhists, they believe in rebirth and karma. What happens is during your life and during previous lives, you accumulate karma, good and bad karma. And the karma determines on what kind of a realm you'll be born again in your next life. And gradually, if you cultivate the way, you end up in enlightenment. And so through cultivation, you break this circle of, or cycle of continuous birth and death, or the wheel of birth and death. And this wheel of birth and death is conceived or perceived by the Buddhists as a process of suffering. So there is a way to get out of this almost vicious circle. So you kind of work your way up.